Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Last month, Republicans descended upon Milwaukee for their presidential nominating convention. Next week, Democrats get their turn in Chicago. And while the nominees were set before the conventions began, these grand political events are more than publicized pep rallies. They've launched careers, ended campaigns, and been the fodder of late-night comedians for as long as they've been televised. Evolving from men in smoke-filled rooms picking nominees to today's high-energy spectacles filled with colorful hats, enthusiastic signs, and big dramatic balloon drops. We're unpacking why presidential conventions are crucial for shaping party platforms, rallying supporters, and setting the stage for the general election. And we're joined by Shannon O'Brien, a professor at the University of Texas, Austin. She specializes in American politics, focusing on the American presidency and political development. Professor O'Brien, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let's begin at the beginning. How did we end up with political conventions in the first place?
Well, oh, that is a long, long story. Well, Democrats, talking about them, around the 1830s, they just wanted to get together to kind of like say, this is our person. Because originally, it wasn't as well organized. They wanted to try to organize this into some sort of organized chaos, might be the best way to put it. And to have them all kind of say, this is our person and this is who we support. If you want to go back way to the founding, which I will only do very briefly. The founders thought we were going to have 13 states and 13 candidates, and that the House of Representatives was going to select the president. By the end of Washington's term, we had two parties. I mean, it kind of fell apart pretty quickly. Yeah, pretty much that idea didn't work. But these conventions kind of coalesced around. And I think that first one was maybe in 1832, maybe. And that was for the Democratic Party. And that was just kind of this way to have like this one voice, and this is our person.
Which makes sense, because if you're going to have two parties, you really got to wrap your heads around who you're going to get behind. And it used to be really contentious. The quintessential men with cigars in back rooms yelling at each other over who the nominee would be.
Absolutely. These were fun and bonkers. And they used to go to the convention not knowing who was going to be the nominee. And they were gearing up for, essentially a giant slog. One of my favorite conventions is actually the 1912 Republican convention. And that's the one where Teddy Roosevelt tried to run for that third term because he was all annoyed with Taft, because Taft didn't do what he wanted him to do. And so there was all these rumors that the Rough Riders were going to show up with guns and take over the convention. And they were going to have fists. And they were having fist fights in the streets. Like the same party, their Taft wing and their Roosevelt wing were like punching each other at bars. And they were going at it. Roosevelt's going to wind up walking out his delegates. He gets up and claims, you're breaking the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal, and then marches his delegates out. And then a month later, he starts another convention called the Progressive Party. These were wackadoodle sometimes, man.
I love that. And I love that you use the word wackadoodle. We also want to hear from you this hour. Did you attend a convention and have a specific memory? Is there a moment from presidential convention history that really sticks out to you? You can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides@wosu.org. So I want to play a clip from the 1932 Chicago Convention. This is when FDR becomes the first major party presidential nominee to accept the nomination in person, which I didn't realize we took all the way until 1932 to do that. But here's FDR.
I pledge myself to a new deal for the American people. Give me your help. Not to win votes alone, but to win in this crusade to restore America to its own people.
So I gotta ask, he's giving a really rousing speech and he's got the crowd and that sounds like conventions today, but why didn't the nominees attend and what made FDR break with tradition?
Well, I'm not 100%, but I'll give you my best.
Okay.
Is historically back in the day, a lot of these candidates spoke through proxies. They actually didn't campaign a lot either for themselves. They had people going around and giving speeches on their behalf because it looked a little too unsavory to,
oh my goodness,
I don't want to say narcissistic, but I think that's kind of where they were going, is that you were supposed to be like,
you were supposed to want it, but not want it.
Yeah.
Okay. I get that.
Yeah. And so they'd have proxies giving speeches for him around the country. That was very commonly 19th century tactic. And then their proxies would be the ones that would sling all the dirt. Mm. They could trash talk. Like a lot. But the candidate could be like, well, I never said that. That was somebody speaking on my behalf.
That held for a long time though, too. I mean, vice presidents were typically supposed to be the attack dogs, and that really held until I'd say about 2016.
Yeah. I mean, well,
here and there.
Yeah, it comes back and forth. I mean, JD Vance is still trying to attack dog.
Oh yeah.
Vice presidents don't have, they're there to balance tickets. They're there to soothe fears over certain issues. Often they're there to sort of round out a ticket. And this also gives them a job. And this also ingratiates them with the presidential candidate too.
I want to ask, when did women start to appear in conventions? Cause in those old images of those smoke filled rooms, it was a bunch of white guys.
Well, the first woman, as I understand, that was ever nominated at all-ish, I think was around the 1920s, even though she didn't make the ticket. But the first woman to really make a speech and make a big splash to convention, that's going to be Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh.
She's going to come in to, what's going to happen is FDR is trying to run for that third term and he actually doesn't make an appearance at that convention. And there's a lot of squabbling going on in that convention because Washington was elected for two terms and then he probably could have been elected until he died, but he stepped away partially because he wasn't feeling real well. And he was afraid he didn't want to set up the precedent that only presidents die in their terms. And Washington did this two-term thing, which everybody else honored. And Roosevelt was breaking that, FDR. And he was gonna try to run for this third term. And also his vice president who had run with him previously had broke with him and was like, no, let's not do that. And so this convention was having this huge squabble over, do we nominate this guy for this third term and upend all of our political tradition to this point? And we got to get this new vice president and work super complaining about it. So Eleanor gets up and says, like, this is not normal time because this is during the World War II. We're not in ordinary time. This is this unusual time. And we essentially need to back him. And that really was the first time a first lady spoke at the convention and was very transformative. And showed that they're not just mouthpieces, they can have voices of their own. But that was really, I'd say, the first big speech from a woman and as a force at a convention.
And we have a clip of First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt from that convention.
This is no ordinary time. No time for weighing anything except what we can best do for the country as a whole. And that rests, that responsibility, on each and every one of us as individuals.
I kind of love her transatlantic accent. I'm sorry that disappeared from our dialect.
Yeah, I always think of her, and I think of Katharine Hepburn in the same the same era too. You hear it and you place it immediately. You know, she can't hide her voice anywhere.
Yeah, And it's interesting because that is this change, because nowadays it's pretty common for the spouses of presidential candidates, of vice presidential candidates, of Senate candidates to introduce their spouse. I mean, you look at the RNC, Usha Vance introduced JD Vance, and you mm-hmm. see Melania comes out before Trump speaks. It's almost tradition now. It's expected.
Yeah. The first ladies have kind of emerged as their, or in this case, what we'll see probably at the DNC, the first gentleman, or the potential first gentleman giving the speech. I think it's the second gentleman giving this giving a speech. We're seeing them as their the best cheerleader for their spouse, the person who knows them best, that's trying to talk about that, to humanize them. I really think a lot of these speeches from these first ladies are really sitting there to humanize the president, and to sit and to kind of give try to give people a little peek under. Through the window of how just how much of a good person they are. I think that's really what's going on.
Yeah, and it's always these moments of like levity. When Usha Vance gets up to introduce JD just last month, she goes, "What can be said about my husband that hasn't already been said? He was the subject of a Ron Howard film," and everybody chuckles, and it's silly, and like it is this moment to help us all remember that they are real people.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think that's one of the things that, like, it's somebody, I study presidents. I love presidents. It's my thing. But one of the things that bothers me is that sometimes we think of them like these big statues in D.C., is these icons that we kind of put all these emotions and all of our stuff into. And the reality is they're just average people. I mean, they're in extraordinary jobs, but they're just like us. And I think that's what makes them so much cooler than anything else.
I have a super difficult question for you. Do you have a favorite convention or a favorite convention moment?
Oh, that's hard to say. There's so many good ones. I have a sweet spot, and every semester I do teach the 1912 conventions. When I teach, that would be the Republican 1912 convention, which leads to the 1912 Progressive Convention, just because the Progressive Convention is so much fun. 68's a delight as well. I mean, whenever you have a group that tries to run a pig for president, you're gonna have fun. Or interesting, you have the 1924 convention, which was the Democratic convention in Chicago, where they tried to decide, are we going to be a pro Ku Klux Klan party or an anti Ku Klux Klan party? And that one was incredibly chaotic as well. I have a sweet tooth for chaos and unusual stuff. Obviously.
I think those are the things that like stick out, rightly or wrongly. They're the moments that we all remember.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking about more of those memorable moments when All Sides continues. And I want to remind you that if you have a memorable convention moment, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides at wosu.org. Our program will continue in just a moment on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. From the 1968 protests to the national debut of Barack Obama, presidential nominating conventions have launched campaigns, ended careers, and written our history for us. We're talking about their history and their place. And still with us is Shannon O'Brien, professor at the University of Texas, Austin, who specializes in American politics, focusing on the American presidency. You know, this year has been quite a year for presidential politics.
You can say that.
That's putting it mildly. But initially, we were having a year of what we might describe as double haters, people who didn't like the current president, Joe Biden, and also didn't like the former president, Donald Trump. But now that Biden has exited the race, we're seeing a contrast between making America great again and we're not going back. And it reminds me a little bit of the first election of John F. Kennedy. And I want to play a clip from his nomination at the DNC.
That is the choice that our nation must make. A choice that lies not merely between two men or two parties, but between the public interest and private comfort, between national greatness and national decline, between the fresh air of progress and the stale, dank atmosphere of normalcy, between dedication or mediocrity.
Kennedy is also someone with a very unique voice.
True enough.
And speaking style. But this generational clash, because at that moment, Kennedy is running against Nixon. I got ahead of myself. And there was that conversation between the young and the old, the new and what used to be. Do you see any similarities between then and now?
I think so. I mean, I think we're at a generational change. One of the things I've been complaining about is, you know, I'm a child of the 80s. I was born in the 70s. And a lot of the people that are still in politics today were in politics when I turned 18. A lot of the people who were in power, I was not eligible to vote for when they first came into power. And I feel that, and I think my students feel that, the younger people, they're like, this doesn't speak to me. Who are these people in my generation? And or in this generation, they're old. And I think Kennedy was saying, you know, we're in a new era. This is something new. And I think
it happened, the start of the space race.
Yeah. And I think, you know, part of what he's kind of saying in that speech is like, you know, that World War II politics is over with. We're in a new, like, you know, cut, change. We're in a new era here, and we need to look forward. We need to stop looking backwards. And he's trying to be very forward thinking and talk about how what he's going to do and how we're going to be transformative. I think we have a lot of the current people in their 20s and 30s are clamoring for that. They don't relate to the people in their 50s and 60s, and they want to see some new dynamic American politics that reflects the values that they were raised with.
Yeah, I was having this conversation before Biden dropped out. I had kind of wondered whether we were going to skip over Gen X entirely for presidents and move from boomer to millennial. I mean, Kamala Harris is Gen X, so I assume that if she wins, then we will have a Gen X president. But if she loses, I don't know. We may leapfrog into millennial the next go around.
Yeah, I feel that so poignantly. Though I have told my students, and I have said this in class, don't wait for your turn. Just leapfrog us, man. It's like, it's painful. But I don't blame you. I blame the boomers. And so leapfrog us, do what you need to do to make sure your voice is heard. Because while, you know, I would love to not have an expiration date, I am, you know, as the older I get, the more I'm aware that I will at some point have one. And the value should be set by the young, man, or the country and the tone and us moving forward. And there's a place for older statesmen and continuity of stuff, but you know, I'm gonna rag on the RNC 2024. I mean, they had Hulk Hogan out. I was like, man, that is a great 1980s nostalgia bit, but I just could in my brain see every Gen Alpha and Gen Zer that was seeing this typing, who is this person?
I know. It's bad. Like when Justin Timberlake was arrested for DUI the other, like a week, month, I'm losing sense of time, but the cop was young enough that he didn't know who he was. I was like, oh, I am getting old.
Yeah. It's a stab in the heart a little bit, actually. it's like, oh, ooh. Yeah. I have a question. I teach this huge class, this monster sized class. I'm going to have 2,000 students in the fall in a class. And their first question is, what's your first political memory? And I asked this last semester. And one of the things is that actually shocked a lot of me and shocked a lot of my TAs is so many students, these are freshmen in college and sophomores, their first political memory is the election of Donald Trump.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I am getting old.
Yeah. It's a good gut check. I find that question to be a great gut check.
Mine is the election between Bill Clinton and Bob Dole, because we had a little election in my elementary school and we went in to vote for who we wanted. And I was very conflicted because my father was a Republican and my mother was a Democrat, and they were very political people. And I was like, I will be betraying one of them by voting for the other.
Oh, I can date you better. My first political memory is Jimmy Carter. Mm. And my parents were Republicans. But I liked the guy who had the big smile and liked peanuts because they had him on a lot of peanut stuff. And I liked the peanut guy because the other guy, which would be Gerry Ford, dressed a lot like my grandpa. And I was like, I want the peanut guy because they have him on peanuts, you know, and that's a 3-year-old memory. And that makes sense.
Yeah.
My dad was just like, the peanut guy won. And I'm like, yay, peanuts. Peanuts for everybody.
I want to talk about Chicago in 1968, not only because the Democratic National Convention is going to be in Chicago again, but the lead up to that convention also took a series of wild and unexpected turns. First, President Lyndon Johnson says, I'm not seeking a second term. Mm-hmm. And then the person seeking the Democratic nomination, the arguable frontrunner, Robert Kennedy, is assassinated after winning the California primary. And here's one of his last speeches.
So my thanks to all of you. And now it's on to Chicago and let's win there. Thank you very much.
In addition to Johnson dropping out and Robert Kennedy being murdered, Martin Luther King is assassinated. There are race riots and tension and civil unrest, and all of this erupts on the floor of the DNC, and it's chaos.
Mm-hmm. It is. And Daley's the mayor, Richard Daley, and he is a strong army in the crowd outside a bit, too. I mean, the crowd outside a bit is even more bonkers in some ways. But this was a convention over what direction is this party going to go? What do we want to do? It actually sets up a lot of changes, which I could be really super nerdy about, because what's going to happen is they're going to wind up with a candidate that they're okay with, but he's not super successful. And then what that's going to lead into is then a bunch of changes. They're going to do some reforms in 72. And then those reforms, they're going to wind up putting more power into the people, which is how they get a Jimmy Carter. And then what happens is in 84, they roll out the superdelegates to make sure that the Democratic elite still have a say in the party. It's in 68, you got to look back. 68 is the nexus, the beginning point, the genesis for all of this stuff, for all of the Democratic Party stuff unfurling for the next 20 plus years. But yeah, the convention was bonkers because you also remember, other thing you didn't mention, this was going to be your first time, I believe, it wasn't the first time, but it was the big fight, was over the draft age and the voting age. You had a lot of young people at that convention super upset because they weren't going to be able to voice their electoral voice. I don't think they get that till 71, but they were still being drafted. And that was a big flashpoint too.
Yeah, here's a clip of Dan Rather reporting live from the 1968 Democratic National Convention.
Dan Rather?
What's your name, sir?
And what is your name, sir? Take your hands off of me.
Dan Rather?
Unless you intend to arrest me, don't push me, please. I know you won't, but don't push me. Take your hands off of me unless you plan to arrest me.
Wait a minute.
Walters, you can see.
I don't know what's going on, but this, these are security people apparently around Dan. And obviously getting roughed up.
We tried to talk to the man, and we got bodily pushed out of the way. This is the kind of thing that's been going on outside the hall. This is the first time we've had it happen inside the hall.
I mean, I guess, like, it's just wild to me that, like, Dan Rather is getting, like, pushed around at the convention by police. It just gives you, like, he was such a household name at that point, and now, like, it just shows, like, what a chaotic moment it was.
Oh, absolutely. And that even though they said they had control of this, they didn't really. And then you want to throw into the mix, you had the Yippies out there, and which are a delightful 1960s counterculture group, which really is your first, like, they got media in a way nobody else did. I mean, they did some crazy things that if you go to the Wall Street Stock Exchange, they now have glass there because the Yippies thought in the 60s it would be funny to throw fake money on the floor to see what happens. They filed for a permit to blow up General Motors. And they tried in 68 at this convention, they tried to get a pig to run. They had a pig named Pigasus that they wanted to be treated as a serious candidate with Secret Service protection and foreign policy briefings. And pig was indeed slang for police at that time. So you can guess what they were trying to do among, you know, aside from just the chaos and then knew the media moments, but they were layering their message in there.
What do you make of the Democrats' decision to go back to Chicago this year?
They love Chicago. They have given so many, they've given conventions in Chicago since the early 19th century. They've been there forever. It's I think if they had realized how chaotic this election season was going to be with the withdrawal of Biden and other issues, they may not have opted for the location that is infamous for their most crazy convention, which is 68 in terms of on the stuff we have on record on media. But I think they wanted to go there because it's a great nexus point. There's lots of stuff to do. It's an interesting city, great restaurants, a good Democratic core base in the city. I think that's what they were thinking. I suspect now there's a few raised eyebrows, but
lots of think pieces about it.
Yeah.
I did want to ask about location because it is a whole long process to pick a location for a convention and what it means and why you would do it in this place versus that place. You know, Trump in 2016 picked Cleveland, Ohio, and Ohio, you know, was a swing state at that point. Obama had won it twice, and it was, you know, the sign of what was to come of a crumbling blue wall that elected Trump president.
Mm-hmm.
And so how much does it matter the city? I mean, I think they always want the city to say something about who they are as a party.
I think there's a lot of dynamics there. I think they want to throw a great party. And so I think they want to get their delegates and energized, and they want people to see when they're watching some of this on TV that they're having a great time. And this is not a trip to the dentist office. This, you know, we're having fun, and you should, you know, support us because we're the awesome team. That's really what a lot of these conventions are doing on that level. The other one, I think, though it's not the right word, but I think it's the right tone, is virtue signaling. I think they're trying to do a lot of, like, virtue signaling with the locations to say, these are our people. This is our core. This, we see you. There's a piece that I, an article I ran across when I was doing some work, because some of my research, I look at where presidents give speeches. That's, I'm kind of interested because if they can go anywhere, why do they go here or there? And we know that if presidents go to small towns, they're more likely to get positive press coverage from the small towns, because the small newspapers, the journalists there are just like, oh my gosh, they see us, they know we exist, and they give them just glowing coverage, even if the state is not particularly supportive of said president to begin with. And I think there's a lot of that logic going into this selection, is It's like you just said, it's a swing state. They want to win it. They want to start, you know, they want to try to get, pull that one into a win. So we're going to get positive coverage. We're going to go there and we're going to try to create a lot of goodwill. That's what I think is going on.
And sometimes they make choices that I will admit I don't fully understand. So in 2004, the re-election of George W. Bush, he chooses New York City. And there is chaos as a result of that. Not the same kind of chaos as 68, but I think, what is it, like 1,500 protesters get arrested that year?
I wouldn't, if for the Republican convention, I would not have picked New York City, because what I just said about positive coverage goes out the window when you get near the big national newspapers like the New York Times. They play by a different rule set than, let's say, you know, the Des Moines Register. And so I think when he went there, I get it. I mean, George, the Bush family is long associated with New England. His granddad, I believe, was a senator from Connecticut. And I kind of can see his, like, sure, let's do that. And like our convention, our delegates are gonna have a great time in New York City, but he dropped it into a Democratic Party stronghold. So that's almost, you know, that's almost like pouring like sugar around the ant farm and going, where'd all these ants come from? You know,
Yeah.
it's of course you're going to get protesters in a stronghold for the opposing party.
Yeah, and I mean, I get it. It was the first convention since 9/11. We
And he
were
wanted to do
going
that
into the
because of
Iraq
that.
War. You wanted that sort of visual, that moment, but yeah, it was chaos. And then the New York City police got criticized for the way they handled it. There were class action lawsuits. It was a whole debacle. And so sometimes you get the kind of news off a convention that you super don't want.
Yeah. I mean, he and I think he did. I think ultimately the decision was like, it's September 11th, let's go there. This is another topic and I don't want to wander too far into it, but sometimes I think, and I had a piece that came out, I believe in the conversation about another piece in the conversation about Biden with this, is I think some of these presidents get so far into their presidential bubbles that they can't see outside of the bubble. And they get this echo chamber going on in there. And I think George W. had been at, you know, the Towers site and had seen all the support for him and thought, they're gonna love me because I was supposed so supportive, but that's a bubble.
Yeah. Our guest this hour is Shannon O'Brien, professor at the University of Texas Austin, who specializes in American politics. Coming up, we're going to talk about how presidential conventions have launched and how they've ended careers. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're a few days away from the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. And Democratic conventions have long served as launching pads for future leaders. Both Presidents Clinton and Obama's national profiles were lifted by their appearances at the convention. We're looking this hour at the history of conventions and where they fit in the history of our country. Still with us is Shannon O'Brien, professor at the University of Texas Austin, who specializes in American politics. So many people were first made aware of Bill Clinton at the 1988 DNC. He was then the governor of Arkansas and gave a speech that almost derailed his career. What happened?
Oh, yeah, that speech. I believe that one was not particularly a great one. He was only about 41 or so at the time. And I believe that he was trying to aspire to higher. And he was like, sure, I'll do it. He wasn't ready for the stage. I do know that. And he wasn't ready for the stage at that moment. And I believe he just kind of kept going on and on.
Yeah.
And on.
And it's funny because he was now, looking back, we know him as somebody who was a good, you might even consider him a great orator, whether you liked his politics or you hated his politics. He has this like almost mythical moment now in, I think it's like in the election against George H.W. Bush, where he like gets down off the stage and walks over to the woman and takes her hand and like gives that I feel your pain moment. But yeah, the first time he speaks, he's a keynote speaker and he bombs. It was only supposed to be a 15-minute speech on policy before endorsing Michael Dukakis, but it goes on for 33 minutes, interrupted by boos and chants.
Yeah.
And it's so bad that when he ends, he actually literally says, in conclusion, and you're like, oh, no, this is not a college term paper.
I believe that's because the speaker of the House at that point, which I think was Jim Wright, was literally doing the slice your neck moment on that speech, trying to get him to stop because they had actually on the teleprompter put wrap it up or some version of that.
It's so
and
bad.
He was ignoring it. And so they got the Speaker of the House to essentially like, kill it, buddy. And he still kept going. And
I guess it proves you can bomb and go on to have a future in politics.
Yeah, I think was it Johnny Carson that said that Bill Clinton just got approved as an over-the-counter sleep aid or sleep?
Oh, no.
For that one.
That's never what you want to hear.
No. But yeah, he recovered. Bill Clinton's a talker. Like I mentioned before, I study speeches, so I've actually logged from Truman to current, every single speech.
Oh my goodness.
That presidents have ever put in the public papers. And I'll tell you, Clinton's a talker, man. The man would talk to a poll, I think, at times. He always had all these informal conversations, but I do think he's better in many ways when he's on his tighter scripted speech, because otherwise he does have a tendency to ramble. And I bet in his head at that moment, he was like, this is my moment. And it was. But the rest of those after the first 10 minutes weren't.
Then, at the 2004 convention, a speech given by a little-known Illinois state senator, Barack Obama, proves to be the highlight of that convention.
And I stand here today, grateful for the diversity of my heritage, aware that my parents' dreams live on in my two precious daughters. I stand here knowing that my story is part of the larger American story, that I owe a debt to all of those who came before me, and that in no other country on earth is my story even possible.
At the time, people, pundits, were blown away. MSNBC's Chris Matthews even says he was so impressed that he says, we have just seen the first American Black president.
Oh, yeah. It was... That convention, let's be honest, that convention was not exciting. That was a
that was John Kerry. No offense to John Kerry.
I think John Kerry is a great statesman, but dynamic he is not. And he had an enthusiasm problem a bit. John Kerry just seems very old statesman-like in many ways.
I think he had some of the same problems Mitt Romney had in connecting with people.
Absolutely. They come from the school of the refined old school statesman who measures their words carefully. And Barack Obama kind of like blows into that convention like this breath of fresh air and offers this dynamic, exciting speech that in many ways livened up the convention. It was almost like it was like a coloring page that was kind of like pale. They were using beige tones. It was a beige baby convention, and he put a lot of color back into it and like made it more dynamic and more exciting and fun. And he talks about, that's where the phrase comes from, which is what he runs on, is, you know, he says like how this skinny kid who, you know, was dreaming of stuff, you know, he could hope, and it was the audacity of hope. And he framed ultimately an entire campaign around the idea of hope and caught America's like attention.
Yeah, and like I said, like Bill Clinton, you know, it's not just Democratic conventions where people have less than desirable speeches. In 2012, actor and director Clint Eastwood spoke to an empty chair representing Barack Obama, and it did not go the way Mr. Eastwood had hoped.
I love that moment. It's because you can see what's in his head. And you can see that they were like, oh my gosh, we're getting Clint Eastwood. We're going to do whatever that man wants because, oh my gosh, we got Eastwood. So you can see that in his head, what he's thinking, which is he's going to be chastising him and pointing out all these flaws. And it's going to be one of these tough guy moments. In reality, it looked like your somewhat half senile grandpa arguing with the TV set or an empty chair next to him. It didn't go well. It looked like a senior moment. It didn't look like the way I know what they wanted it to look like in his head.
Yeah. I think the lesson there was, if you're going to put an extra chair on stage during your speech, something needs to be in it, because I happen to think that Jim Justice's baby dog was adorable this month ago. And I was like, cool, we're bringing the dog out.
Yeah, they should have at least stuck like a photo of him on something. And also, I think the part of it was also that chair, because I believe it was like one of those little low back slopey chairs. So it wasn't the best chair. I mean, they should have, if it were me and I were programming the RNC on that one, I would have brought out what looks like a kingy chair.
Yeah.
Like a big like royal monarchy chair, and then plastered Obama's face on the back of it to sort of skewer that and say he's acting like a king and that's not what we like. I would have done that. But no, they had to go with the bar stool, basically.
I want to take a call from Dwight in Columbus, who says he has a funny story about Bill Clinton's first speech.
And Barack and I were raised with so many of the same values.
That was we had a mistake there. Dwight, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Sorry about that.
Well, there's a wonderful story about Bill Clinton, show how brilliant a speechmaker he was. When he gave his first State of the Union address, when he got up to teleprompter, he saw that it was an inauguration address instead. He turned around, said something to Al Gore. Al Gore left to track down George Stephanopoulos, said, "You got the wrong speech." Clinton started giving his State of the Union speech on the cuff, and they quickly ran the teleprompter up to where he was, never missed a beat. Nobody ever knew until the following Saturday in a one-to-one with Peter Jennings, it came out that he had done that. And the joke was that if it was Ronald Reagan, he probably would have gone ahead and given his inauguration speech. But it was just a brilliant moment.
Thanks, Dwight. That's so, oh my gosh, imagine being the person who put the wrong speech up.
Oh gosh. No, it's great. That's a great story. It is, and if what I know, it's absolutely true. And you're absolutely right about Reagan. Reagan and I think George W. Bush would have read the speech, because both of them had a tendency to read what was written for them. But what happened with Bill Clinton, I know this from, there's another guy that I've been at a bunch of like conferences and stuff with, who studies like some of these types of specific speeches. Clinton, and he talked about this one time, Clinton actually goes in and he reads all the speeches and he actually hand marks them all up and changes a lot of the little words to make it sound a little more like himself. And he really works through all of his speeches very carefully. We know Barack Obama did the same thing. And so he knew the speech probably by heart by the time it went, and that's why he could do it. Reagan, for example, he wouldn't meet with the speechwriters, and so they had to do Reagan impressions usually.
Yeah, no, most of my knowledge about how this works comes from the West Wing, so. But yeah, it's a complicated thing giving a big speech like that. And I mean, I have a lot of respect for anybody who gets up on a national stage in front of hundreds of thousands of people, both at home and in person, and has to speak for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour. And I also give a lot of credit to the speech writers who put those together, because, I mean, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, the Republican National Convention that we just had, because Trump starts off reading his speech. But then we get about, I want to say, 15, 20 minutes in, and according to news reports, the teleprompter stops because he's going to go off speech. And then when he finally, like, circles back around, the teleprompter starts moving again. And that's a very complicated thing. Trump is particularly known for doing that as well. He gets to a place and he's like, you know, we're going to go in a different direction.
Yeah. The fact he made it 15 minutes surprised me. It's usually like 5 or 6 before Trump goes off speech. Donald Trump cannot stay on scripted speech. He just can't. And I think it's because he starts thinking of things and he wants to talk about that thing and talk about this thing. The fact that they have somebody on his teleprompter that will go back and swing back means they have somebody working that who is very familiar with him and knows his speeches by heart and knows when he's getting back into it. Probably a very good showrunner might be the best way to put it. But that, yeah, he can't stay on speech. He thinks of things. He thinks of stories. He knows that they have popped before. He knows that he has gotten a good reaction from a crowd before. And he just has got to go for it the moment he thinks of it. And that's, I think, why you can't keep him on speech. But yeah.
Yeah, and he got some criticism for the RNC speech being too long. Like, you even watch the crowd, you look around. I think it went almost 90 minutes, which is very long for a speech. It's at the end of the night. The people in the pit are on their feet. And it was one of those, like, by the end, you could see people checking their phones, shuffling around, like, fidgeting. And that's not what you want. But 90 minutes is a long speech.
Oh, yeah. I've said this before. And I mean this very sincerely. I think Trump's his own worst enemy is if he could just discipline himself to do a 10-minute speech, to do a 20-minute speech, I think his speeches would be much better received, because the longer he goes, the less people listen, the less people pay attention, the more times like, oh, I've heard that before. I've heard that before. Because he loves to give the same bits of speeches again and again and again and again and again. And that's actually not that unusual for presidents, but they have a tendency to drop them in, though. They don't typically give the same speech again.
Yeah, somebody who's covered congressional candidates and other politicians in elections, you follow them around long enough and you learn the stump speech yourself. They start talking and I'm like, oh, it's this part again.
Yeah, I was working on one time this thing, and when George W. Bush was doing midterms, I think it was the first set of midterms, he had this set piece that was like, you drew the short end of the straw today, you got me instead of Laura. I believe he said it over 60 times.
It is. There's these like little folksy jokes that they tell over and over and over again. And if you follow them for any period of time, you're like, oh, it's time for the wife joke.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like, yeah, I used to follow a Republican around Oregon who used to say that the social safety net should be more of a trampoline and not a hammock, because Lord knows you don't want him trying to get out of a hammock.
That's pretty good, actually.
Oh, it was good. It was a nice self-deprecating joke, but my gosh, I can't tell you how many times I heard it.
Yeah, no, I know. I was working on some speeches recently, and Reagan had this great little bit where he would talk about, like, puppies with their eyes closed, and they were Democratic. Little kid went to the pet store and they were Democratic puppies. And then he said, I want to come see the Republican puppies. And he's like, well, why are they now Republican puppies? Well, their eyes are open. He had this great bit and everybody laughed. And then George H.W. Bush, his vice president, when he tried to start campaigning for president, he just was not naturally funny. He tried. God love him, but he just was not naturally funny, because his joke was that his dog has gotten spoiled at the White House. She keeps asking for the wine list with her Alpo.
Oh.
Yeah, he tried it multiple times, and it just it just wasn't funny, man. It's, you're just like, oh, you need new material, dude.
That was Shannon O'Brien, professor at the University of Texas, Austin, who specializes in American politics, focusing on the American presidency and political development. Thank you so much for talking all things presidential conventions this hour. It was fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot, too. Thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. And thank you all so much for listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.